Hello, this is Julianne Good, and you're on Psych 101. Thank you for joining us. And tonight we are talking about psychology, making it a little more understandable, informative, and hopefully entertaining. And hopefully you can take away some of the, you know, some of the tips that we're talking about tonight. And tonight we are going to be delving into the issue of childhood sexual abuse. My guest this evening is Martha Nix Wade. She is the founder and executive director of A Quarter Blue. And this foundation is for child sexual abuse prevention and healing, protecting children and restoring families. A little bit about her background. Martha acted from ages 4 to 25 on such shows as Serena, The Waltons, Janice Horton, and Days of Our Lives. She has a BA in dance from UCLA. She has a master's in intercultural studies from Biola University. She has a teaching credential from Whittier College. And she has been the executive director of A Quarter Blue for several years now. Welcome, Martha.
Thank you for having me, Julianne.
So can you tell us a little bit about your foundation and what is the significance of the name A Quarter Blue?
The significance of A Quarter Blue is that a quarter of children will be left blue from the trauma of sexual abuse. However, education is the key to prevention. It's believed that 95% of sexual abuse is preventable through education. So we do seminars to help parents, professionals, how to understand how to better parent their children or interact with children so they are less likely to fall prey to the ploys of a pedophile. Also, we have created resources that help bridge that topic because a lot of people don't know how to start that conversation with a child. So we have a preschool prevention guide, a guide for trusted adults to better understand how to parent and how to detect sexual abuse and understanding what pedophiles do to eke their way into a family and create those trusted relationships that numb a family and numb a child and make sexual abuse normal, which unfortunately people believe it is that are pedophiles, but it's not. It's counter the love a child needs. And then as we were working with people in the prevention edge, you know, you automatically meet people who have been sexually abused. And so for many years, we've been in existence for 10 years, we would refer out to professional psychologists. And then we realized that there's so many elements of healing individuals and their families that we wanted to start groups and offer individual therapy. And so starting actually in November of last year, we started art therapy, and then we had a parent support group where the parents started to understand what were the challenges their children were experiencing as they were healing through sexual abuse so that the child wasn't being scolded for what they were doing because it seems so abnormal. But actually, for a victim of sexual abuse, certain things are quite normal. And if you love them through that and help them understand and how to move from those destructive decisions to productive ones, you're really healing the child and the family. And so it was really exciting watching that process of change. And you actually were part of that change of being the therapist with another therapist, Elizabeth Rivas, working with those families and watching that change. And that just led us to a point where we wanted to have even more groups, because really groups focused on families who have experienced this trauma are very few. They might deal with the effects of molestation, but rarely focus on, okay, this is what you've experienced as a victim of sexual abuse. Let's help you work through that. So now we offer not only art therapy and parent support group, but women's support group. We are working on creating men's support group, equine therapy, which is horse therapy. We are looking at a summer with pet therapy, art therapy for children. Also a Friday night where there is something for every family member, where there's going to be sculpting for teen boys. There is a group for teen girls that we're going to look at heroines in films and look at their characteristics and what allowed them to rise above the challenges they experienced to become heroines that we, you know, cheer for in films, because we want to celebrate these girls and what they're having to overcome and how they're becoming heroines, really, in conquering what happened to them as children. We also have the child element, where there will be for the primary victim a group and then for the secondary victim, because even though there may only be one child in a family who has directly experienced sexual abuse, the ripple effect affects everyone in the family, including the other children. And we want to give help to those children who are the secondary victims, while also their parents and their other sibling are receiving therapy too. So it's a really exciting summer. Looking forward to being a part of the healing process with these families who've experienced the trauma of sexual abuse.
It sounds like a huge undertaking.
It's an exciting one, though. It's enormous, but it's really exciting to know the potential of change and transformation in the lives of these people.
Right, and I've experienced it too as being one of the therapists. And in the first parent group, which was very exciting, and we were up at Skid Row Studios and doing one of the interviews with our parents for that, and that was wonderful. And just to see the change that they had gone through in just 8 short weeks was amazing.
It was truly amazing, and that's an episode that you can download on Skid Row Studios on the show An Exposed Secret. And it's the parents sharing, you know, the challenges, but also the triumphs as they better understood their child and were able to transform not only their child, but we watched 2 marriages be healed.
Exactly.
It was truly amazing to watch the restoration in these families. And it's ongoing. It's only gotten better. And many of our families, one of the other parents experienced sexual abuse as a child. You know, this is a cyclical crime where if it happened to one parent, it's going to tend to affect their child if they haven't personally dealt with it. So not only did they come into our programs dedicated to healing their child, but now as a couple, they're receiving therapy and healing, and as individuals, they're receiving the same. And we're going to watch, I believe, the cycle of abuse stop in these families of the people whom we're working with.
Right, and exactly. This is the main message that one of the main messages, that if abuse has occurred, it needs to stop. Something needs to come in within that system and change it. Otherwise, the victim goes on and gets into more abusive relationships as he or she grows up. And then the cycle continues in some form of abuse, one way or the other, if they don't go in and get some help somewhere. And then it can be multi-generational. If one person has not healed up from it, then all of a sudden it transforms into the next generation, for the next generation to be open to being possible victims also, because the original victim has not healed up from that process. Would you agree?
Absolutely. You need to be a student of yourself. When you've experienced a traumatic experience, and while my personal experience is being a victim of sexual abuse, there are other types of trauma that you can experience as a child, and it will duplicate itself generationally if you do not become a student of self and shine the light upon yourself, because who you've become, while it feels very normal, typically is not. It's all you know. So you believe that's how people are. And then your child believes, oh, that's just how I'm supposed to be. I did not experience clinical depression except for one point in my life, but I believe it was more depression, not clinical. I needed perspective, not medicine. And fortunately, I gained perspective I was ready to take my own life. And I literally heard a booming voice say, I gave you life, what right do you have to take it away? And that scared me straight.
I bet.
I continued driving straight, actually curving on the road instead of driving straight to take my life and take away that momentary pain. And as I got that perspective, I realized I was given a life and I survived through my abuse so I could have a greater impact. And I needed to understand who I was and the potential of who I could be as I dissected what were my reactions, what were my triggers, what became my coping mechanisms. And we need to all do that and be a constant student of self so that we understand ourselves and can better parent or better be a friend. You don't have to have children to have a marked difference on stopping this crime. You can look at yourself, you can talk openly and not think, I need to be quiet about this. I was to blame for that. If only I had... No, wait. You are a child. You have no fault in the crime. You are an innocent victim, 100%. it wasn't you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. You were where you were supposed to be at the moment because that's where your parent took you. You hold no guilt for that incident or incidents. And that's the first thing you need to do is release that from yourself. Take that backpack off, throw it on the ground. That is not yours to bear. The only person who is guilty is the perpetrator. And if he or she had an accomplice, because sometimes they do. One person sets up the opportunity for that pedophile. In my case, there was a husband and a wife. And she was always there when my parents took me, giving the facade of here were a husband and wife, helping care for children. And they loved children so much. And so this was great because they never got to have children of their own. At one time, I asked my mom, "Mom, did you ever take me over there when it was just him?" She said, "I would never have done that." And that is true. She wouldn't have. They were known as the overprotective parents. And how often has a parent said to me, "Oh, that would never happen to my child. I watch them like a hawk."
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, all the time.
That was my parents. The only place I was allowed to go without their supervision was to this home. It appeared safe. Anytime I was dropped off, there were five adults in that room. The husband and wife were World War II veterans. He was a pilot. She was a nurse. They were caring for their aging parents. It looked foolproof. And it was a place where we could have fun because they had toys for children and they became that fun house. But really, it was more like that carnival fun house.
Yeah, the horror
really
house.
Scary.
Right, exactly.
Right. And you know, a lot of people want to say, "Well, duh." You know what? You can say that very often. You can look at the pictures of my perpetrator online and think, "Well, they should have known." You know what? Someone looks a lot worse and a lot more scary when they're under investigation for a sex crime. They've got that look of deer in a headlights. They look slimy, but it's also because you know what they've done now. The average perpetrator you would never pick out of a crowd unless you truly understand pedophilia and the signs to look for and how they are watching children within society, watching family structures, understanding how what's called groom, not only the individual child, but the family. And that's by offering help in babysitting or to drive a child somewhere because the parent's so busy or just hanging out and being part of the family and normalizing their presence in your family structure. Mm-hmm. And then saying to a child, you know, "Hey, here's a candy bar. Don't tell your mom I gave this to you because, you know, you don't want to ruin your dinner. It's our little secret." That's something that maybe we've even said to a child because we love them and we love candy. We didn't mean it in an insidious manner, but a pedophile uses that to see if that child's going to go, "Hey, look at the candy bar that uncle gave me." And if the child does that, they might think this isn't a safe one to invest time in. Mm-hmm. But if we teach our children that secrets are not to be, there are surprises, but there are not secrets. And if someone tells you it's our little secret, you need to tell mom or dad immediately.
Right. Yeah, because you're right. Predators are masters of manipulation.
Absolutely.
And disguise.
Absolutely.
And how many times have it's come up in the media lately that, "Well, we never thought that so-and-so was a perpetrator because he or she was so nice to the kids and always so friendly." And, you know, almost that sicky sweet sort of, you know, happy, we're happy around the kids and we'll do anything for you. And we're here and we'll give you hugs and all this support that you're not getting from your family. I think the perpetrators really hone in on children who look like they've got a vulnerable family system.
Right. When the child's naive, that's what they're looking forward to encountering. And one perpetrator said, he said, "That's great if you don't teach your child about sex, then I can." And we need to be the educators of our children. As we're watching television, as something pops up of sexual content, instead of quickly switching off the television, we need to turn it off and say, "Do you know why mom's uncomfortable with you watching this?" And have that discussion, whether the child, you know, be 16 or 11, adapt your conversation where it's appropriate. But if you just turn it off and have no conversation, that child will go to school and find out what that meant when the person was taking a bite out of a hamburger and going,
Right.
So who's going to teach?
Right, which is all over the place, especially on commercials nowadays.
Right, and it doesn't matter if you're watching something late at night or something in the middle of the day. Commercials are going to be sharing sexual content with children. And if we just think our children aren't taking this in, we're wrong. And if they start to have those seeds of sexual curiosities, a pedophile is going to use and abuse that. And we need to be the educators, not perpetrators. Perpetrators look forward to having a naive child such as myself. That was not a conversation in our home. And we need to make that open conversation with our children. We don't need to pull out books and show pictures. We need to just say, the parts under your bathing suit are yours and yours alone to care for. And that's why I want you, as soon as you can, to start wiping yourself. I want you to be bathing yourself so you are in control of those private parts, and that we use the terms penis, vagina, and it's just out there. It's not, oh, the hoo-ha and the wee-wee. That puts it almost cute and playful. Mm-hmm. And so when a perpetrator is trying to play with a hoo-ha, you know, it's just something to be minimalized as how important it is to protect. And a child needs to know that is yours to care for. And even if a child falls asleep in their bed, our normal practice as a parent would be to take off their clothes and change them into pajamas. I encourage parents to do differently, that if the child's asleep, you can gently wake them up and say, would you like to sleep in those clothes, or would you like me to help you get in your pajamas? If the child gives permission, okay, we'll do it. And if that child is so out of it that we don't do it, we let them sleep in their clothes. It's not that important.
Yeah, it's not that big of a deal either. It teaches self-empowerment.
Exactly.
It teaches the message of, I own my body. No matter
how control
old,
of
exactly,
this.
No matter how young or old I am, I should have control of my body. That is one of my main rights as a human.
Mm-hmm. And that's the problem.
That.
So many people are numbed to their rights over their bodies. And that's why in college, 25% of girls in college will either have an attempted rape or a rape that goes all the way through. And if we would start teaching children as they're toileting, as we're bathing, here's the washcloth. You're in control of your body. Let me talk you through how you do this. Because I want you to know that you're in control of that, and that's something of yours to protect and take care of. It changes the whole perspective of, this isn't just out here for you to do whatever you want to because everybody did it for me, you know? Because some people, they are crazed over skid marks in underwear, you know? But I would never let my child wet them, wipe themselves because then they're going to have skid. I said, I would much rather have skid marks in my kids' underwear. Really, what big of a deal is it? You talk them through how to, and you show them, okay, we don't want these there, so this is how you want to wipe better. Mm-hmm. And it's just giving them that power and letting go of some of our things that we might be repulsed at, such as skid marks. And it's just teaching them empowerment, which is so valuable in raising a child and ultimately protecting them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So how... when you have children in your groups, what is the starting point of getting them to heal up? How do you start that? How do you start that conversation? I'm really curious about that, and I'm sure some of our listeners are too. How do you start that conversation that can be really uncomfortable?
Actually, in our groups with children, most kids, when they've experienced sexual abuse, they don't want to talk about it. You know, they want to be happy. They've had enough time, especially if they've gone through trial, where they had to tell somebody their story. And then they had to see that person, possibly. They really don't want to talk about that. They said, but I'm a happy person. I know, that's great, you're happy. But you deal with effects. If they need to talk directly about sexual abuse, that's more likely going to come up in individual counseling. And even a lot of times as a child, that's not going to come up. You're dealing with the behaviors that are a stem of their sexual abuse. For example, in our art therapy, you can go on our Facebook page and look at our albums of our art exhibits. And we just recently had a handful of art exhibits that celebrated the artworks of doors. We had 20 doors that our families created. And one side shows the backside of abuse, the scary part, the uncomfortable part, and what happened behind closed doors. on the other side shows how they're breaking through and free from that abuse and the triumph and the healing that they're experiencing. Well, when we did the negative side for the kids, it was really a remarkable process to watch. First of all, the colors they chose were not necessarily the colors we would associate with the negative experience, the scary part. They were quite bright colors, you know, pink, purple, like a unique green that one of our boys was creating. And they were painting their doors. And as the time passed, the colors transformed to be pretty bleh. They kept covering up and covering up and covering up. Well, what happens then is like they put their fear on there, even though the colors were different than we would have chosen to show negativity. But what did they do? They covered it up and they illustrated through their artwork what sometimes they would say is, I don't want to talk about the bad stuff. Mm-hmm. And they ultimately did because their doors really became covering up what happened to them. And the colors aren't really pleasing to the eyes. You feel the heaviness that they're covering. But it allowed us to talk to them about it's okay for you to be you. You don't have to cover up who you are. You're uniquely you, and that's okay.
And that's interesting. You know, you figure that the multiple layers is probably what they're feeling in their heads, in their souls, in their hearts, and cover. We'll just keep on burying it deeper and deeper, you know, and starting off with a beautiful color. They knew who they were before the abuse occurred. And then all of a sudden, probably because of the manipulation, the perpetrator sitting there saying, you know, if you tell anybody, I'm going to kill you. If you tell anybody, I'm going to hurt you. I'm going to take away something that is precious to you. So they had all the threats on top of their heads, and they had to go down and bury their true selves.
Well, and also there's a large part of us who typically dissociate. And that means basically while the trauma's taking place, we go elsewhere. We create a world that's safe and fun and playful because what's happening to our physical bodies is anything but playful and fun. It's scary. It's uncomfortable. It's confusing. So we go elsewhere. And so like one of our girls, as she was painting, she left it blank and it led us to a conversation I wanted her to finish. And as we worked through it, she's just like, but I don't remember. And I said, well, there's a lot I don't remember either. And that's why we're together in this. You know, even in my life today, I'll try to remember something that happened and it's poof, gone. Mm-hmm. Where I sometimes am scared, like, is this early onset Alzheimer's? But it's still that it plays out where I might not remember everything today. And she's going through that, even though she's very young. And so I just said, what's the color that shows that lack of memory? And she created this grayish brown. But that's very telling. But at the same time, to show her that there are other people in our group that are going through the same exact thing. Because another person who was there started to talk and say, I don't remember. Something happened in a tub and I just don't remember. I said, see, you're not alone. Here are three of us in three different age brackets. And we all struggle with memory. Mm-hmm. And it's not even traumatic memory. It might be just like, what's your name?
Right.
And it transfers itself and we're all working on how to remember the healthy memories. And sometimes it's okay not to remember the trauma. Maybe we're not ready. Maybe we'll never remember that. And it's okay. We don't want to have that part of some people have said, bring it on. I remember everything. It's please don't do that. That's very destructive. Mm-hmm. You may never be able to remember your details of abuse, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, it's the brain sets up a protective mechanism, and it is a naturally occurring situation under times of trauma, period. And it's there for a reason. It's there to protect you so that you can keep on going on with life. And whatever happened, you need to compartmentalize it and just you need to let parts of it go, period.
Right.
Because otherwise, you're right, it could end up destroying you. You could end up going into this dark abyss of depression and not come out of it.
So often it's counterproductive to remember all the elements of trauma. And it's not necessarily going to help your healing. There are some times where maybe you're stuck, and with the help of a licensed therapist or someone who's trained in what's called EMDR, I've never experienced hypnosis. I know some people endorse it. For me, I prefer EMDR. And my experience in how to understand, explain it is, for me, what I needed to work through is why I was a control freak and why, under the most innocent of situations, I was teaching kindergarten at the time, and the kindergartners would surround me, and there were approximately 40 of them. Most of them spoke Spanish. And so they'd start poking me and go, "Maestra, maestra, maestra." And I wanted to curl up in a ball and disappear. And I had to think in my head, okay, these are 5-year-olds. They're not going to hurt you. They're little fingers. There's nothing more. But it started to become almost a gripping fear. And this was where I was working, and I needed to work through that so I wasn't scared of 5-year-olds. That was ridiculous. So I went to my therapist, and I said, okay, I believe I'm ready for EMDR. Do you think I'm ready? She goes, I do. Because a year prior to that, when I heard someone talk about it, I'm like, that is freaky. Never going to do that. Because what EMDR does is you go in with something you want to work through. Mine was feeling fear, gripping fear when I wasn't in control. And the therapist asks, different questions. And they're not leading. They're just asking about, when do you feel those situations? And for me, I wanted to start working on it in my relationship with my husband, because when I got to that place of orgasm, it freaked me out, and I would pull back to not experience that ultimate sense of release, because then I was out of control. But when she started asking me those questions, it was too close. So I dealt with the kids poking me in the kindergarten classroom. And as she's asking these questions of how does that make me feel and all that, she's moving her finger back and forth. And the theory of it is basically we record our life in our head, mm-hmm. like a movie, and it's all there. And when you dissociate, that movie's kind of off of its reel. It's there, but it's not locked and loaded where we remember it. And as you watch the finger go back and forth, it's associated with the REM sleep, where our eyes go back and forth to process our dreams. And as you're being asked these questions and it's taking you to that point of wherever you're uncomfortable, it has the potential of taking that film that's off of its reel, locking and loading it, and you having that memory. But it's an amazing process that you have that memory. And for me, it took 3 hours. And fortunately, my therapist knew me well enough, so she blocked off a Saturday, knowing it was going to take me a long time. Because like probably after an hour, I'm like, okay, this is dumb. Nothing's happening. She's like, please stay with it. Mm-hmm. And she knew part of it is growing up as an actor, you learn to play a certain role, and to play a role, not be actually in the real moment of life. And so she knew that I needed more time to really get into who I was as an individual, not who I was playing, to appease her in this strange therapy.
Martha as Martha.
Yes, there is a Martha as Martha. And so ultimately, and I'm not going to share the details of what I experienced, because like I said, you don't need to remember everything. You don't need to hear the gritty details of my sexual abuse, because then it could trigger you at this moment, and you're not in a therapist's office being able to really work through that. But I had very severe memories of, and very descriptive memories of, what took place as a child. And in EMDR, as you're remembering them, you're doing everything you wanted to do as a child, but were unable to, whether it be saying no, screaming, crying, pushing out, cleaning up, grabbing Kleenex, everything that you would have done if you felt free to protect yourself. But because, as for myself, I was almost robotic because I was taught to obey my elders. I did it. I was unable to complain. My opinions didn't matter. I was obedient. I was obedient at home as a child and daughter. I was obedient on the set to the directors. And as my role as a child of sexual abuse, I was obedient to my perpetrator. But that wasn't who I was inside. I was screaming. I was crying. I was cleaning up. I was running away. In EMDR, all of that comes out. And so as you're doing what you wanted to do as a child, you become at peace because everything you wanted to do, you just did. That you feel completely healed, where I could tell you exactly what happened in my memories, but I'm no longer gripped by the fear and the anger about what happened that day so many years ago. It's a fact. I cannot change the past. And look at me now, I'm okay. And my husband was there as all this was taking place.
It's amazing.
And he ended up having to go back for EMDR on what he had just seen happen because he just watched his wife get molested. And it was very traumatic. And he wasn't detached from it because he had to sit idly by and quiet so as not to disrupt what happened. He probably wanted to run to my perpetrator's house and kill him.
Yeah, and I'm sure he wasn't ready for that shock of hearing that story.
No, he literally, without the man being present, he watched vile sexual acts take place to a little girl. And I was in an adult body, but it was very, very real. And difficult because as a husband, he wants to protect. And that was part of what, you know, as it became public about my perpetrator, it became public when I was approximately 25. And my niece is also a victim. So there was one point where her husband and my husband sat down and they were like, okay, how can we get him? Because he was not in jail. He was not in jail because of statute of limitations. There was actually at the time I could have come forward. I didn't understand my abuse at that time. I thought I'd be laughed off the witness stand. And so I focused on my healing, not realizing, one, there were other victims. There were other victims that needed me to take a stand and report what I knew, as small as it was. Because at the time, all I remembered were wet kisses. I logged it as a child logs it. I remembered being wet and not being wet. And there are so many forms of moisture when you're being sexually abused. And I didn't understand it. All I understood as a seven-year-old little girl were kisses. So that's how I categorized everything that took place. I didn't have the appropriate understanding. And not that you want to explain to your children all sexual intimacy, but I didn't understand that it wasn't okay for someone to be kissing me a certain way, kissing me too long, that I could have said stop.
But you didn't have that power when you were a little girl.
No, I was told to obey my elders,
exactly.
So I did.
Exactly.
If that's truth. And no, you're not supposed to obey at all costs.
Well, and that's the thing too with victims is that they can sense underneath it all the craziness that something's not right here. But I don't know quite what to say because I'm a little kid and you're a big adult, or you're older than me or stronger than me, or you have some sort of power over me, because that is what molestation is about, is power of one person over another, period. It really doesn't have to do with a sexual act, even though it's embedded in it. It is the power of one person over another and taking an innocent child and destroying that, because once that happens, that child is never the same again, period.
Well, and I mean, that's the cycle of abuse. Quite often, people who are pedophiles were victimized as children. They bought into the lie that this was love. And you can go on different sites and look that people who are involved in pedophilia, they will defend their rights. And they say, how dare you say that this is not a mutual love, a consensual love? This child loves me, and that's why he or she is performing in these acts of love with me. And and they've bought into the lie because that's the lie they were taught as children. And it, what they don't understand is it is not consensual. A child wants attention. And if they're not receiving appropriate attention from their parents or other loved ones of unconditional love, they will be numb to the sense of someone coming and say, this is what brothers do. This is what people who love one another do. And so they go, oh, this is love? Okay, I'll do it because you're going to spend time with me and get me ice cream and take me to Disneyland. And so, okay, this is what we do. And they have buy into it because, well, at least part of it's fun. And not always do their bodies say, ouch, or this is uncomfortable. Because it normalizes itself often and the body's somehow stimulated on its own, then it becomes really confusing because there is part of you that goes, is this really okay? Should I tell somebody about this? But there's something that feels kind of good. But there's something that kind of feels wrong. But I don't want to get in trouble. And if it's wrong, I'm going to get in trouble for this. And I don't want to get in trouble. So I'll just keep quiet about this. You're very conflicted as a child. Mm-hmm. Because if nobody's had this conversation with you, your body's trying to figure it all out with this, the stimuli happening in your body and the endorphins going, oh, wow, this feels, oh, wait, no. And you're so confused and you have no one to talk to about it. And the only person who's feeding you information about it is saying, this is what you do with someone whom you love.
Mm-hmm. And then the victim shuts down and dissociates and goes someplace else mentally,
and,
period.
And very often they go to other classmates and duplicate that because they want to be loved at school too. This is how we love one another. So let's do this because I like you as a friend and I want to take that to a different level. And then they become perpetrators. Mm-hmm. And it's a vicious cycle just bathed in lies and confusion. And we need to educate our children so that if someone is grooming them to that, they'll go, wait, I got the answer to this one. You know, you think of how much time a child is spending being educated. I think it's, 1,400 hours in a year they're spending on math, science, history, etc. And probably zero of that time is in educating them about how they are important, their bodies are important, and how they need to stand up and speak out about protecting their bodies. And if anybody does something to their bodies, they need to shout out for help. We spend very little time on that, but really, it's the greatest risk to our children right now. Mm-hmm. It is believed that at least 1 out of 4 children will be sexually assaulted before the age of 18.
And then perpetrators have multiple victims.
Absolutely. And the statistics on that are all over the place. You know, The one that I've read and I think is probably the most real is 350.
Wow. That's...
they're that
That's
good.
That's too much, right.
They are that good. They
horrible.
Are typically that likable. People think that they're the slimy stranger that you would know. No. You won't know. Very often they're the people that you're like, they're pretty cool. Yeah, I'll trust my kid with them. And if your kid doesn't understand that likable people could do harmful things, then they're going to, like, if it's a coach, they're going to be like, this is going to affect my playing time. Oh, my teammates are going to be angry at me if I say anything, so I'll just keep quiet. I'm the only one, so I'll just sacrifice myself so the team stays together, the team stays happy. I become a better pitcher. Kids justify it because a lot of times a child, because they don't have self-esteem, because they're looking for others to esteem them. If the coach is esteeming him or her, because of how they're pouring in, that becomes their identity. And they're willing to sacrifice themselves for the good of the community, whether it be a team, a church, a synagogue, their family. You know, if it's dad or mom, they don't want anybody else to know because they don't want to split apart the family. They don't want to lose their home. They don't want to be not having food on their table. And everybody's justifying it away instead of shedding the light on what's truly going, and that our children need to be protected. They need to know that their voice is valuable,
yes,
and to speak up. And we need to hear them when they speak up and not just kind of talk over them or ignore them later, fall asleep, watch TV. We need to be engaged in conversation with our children.
Mm-hmm. I agree totally. And just if any of our listeners would like to join in this conversation, with Martha Nix Wade. Give us a call at 800-893-9562. Again, that's 800-893-9562. And also as a reminder, you can download this program from iTunes or any of the previous programs by just typing in Psych 1-on-1, and that's P-S-Y-C-H, the number 1, O-N, and another number 1. So if you'd like to join us, please give us a call. And Martha, now working with all the people that you've worked with so far, what has been one of the biggest challenges of working with children who have been sexually abused and their families?
I hate to bring it to this, but money. The need is great, and we pour a lot into our work on very little. And if you think about it, probably the average therapy, and you could correct me on this, is somewhere between $100 to $150 an hour. These families don't have it. And, you know, a lot of the families we're working with are middle class. And so, and a lot of the programs are for people who are in a lesser economic range. And so there are services for them. There aren't a lot of services for people who are middle class. And, but they don't have the funds. And some of our families literally are in individual therapy. And let's say they are 4 people, individual therapy. So if you're all going individual, and let's go on the low side, that's $400 a week. But you also go as a family, so you learn how to use all your tools together. That could $500 a week. How many of us could put $500 aside every week?
Very few.
Right.
Very few.
And not only that, but if I was a victim of sexual abuse and I'm writing a $500 check every week, I'm reminded every week that I'm paying for someone else's crime.
Mm-hmm.
And that saddens me. I was very fortunate. My abuse took place in a church. The church not only reported it to the officials, but they put a lien on his home. He paid for my counseling.
That's rare.
Oh, it's crazy rare. And even if someone is prosecuted, the restitution sometimes is maybe like $35 a month. That's not going to touch most therapies. And so we are working, and we ask for a $10 donation for our services. However, if they're unable to do that, we say, work with us. We want you to have some buy-in to your healing, but we don't want to put a hardship upon the family. And so we are looking for donors to come alongside and to what I envision is like bridge the gap to say, I know I didn't cause this trauma, but the person who did is not going to stand in the gap for you. And you really don't want them to stand in the gap. So in between your pain and the darkness, let me stand on in between so you can cross over into lightness and healing. Let me stand in the gap for you. I am so hopeful that people will catch a vision of that and say, let me stand in the gap for this 10-year-old. Let me stand in the gap for this mom. Let me stand in the gap for this family. Let me take on that burden financially because I can. And so we're asking if people would come alongside at a $25 donation per individual, per week. And you don't have to do every week. You could say, I want to cover all therapies for a week. I want to cover it for a month. So here's $100 to supplement their therapy. And there's individual therapy offered. And like I said earlier, there's group therapy, whether it be your gender or your age bracket, or you want to focus on a certain therapy, whether it be pet or art. We actually started developing today salsa therapy.
All right.
Yes.
There's Zumba therapy too.
We'll get there. We need the professional to come in who has a psychology and Zumba experience and wants to implement that. But it's going to be couples therapy. They'll go through the couples therapy and then for 8 to 10 weeks, and then they'll move on to the salsa therapy. And it's, and let me see, literally this was today. It's hot healing something. It's 3 H's. And we literally developed the curriculum today to take them through of how working through salsa and the elements, which you'd learn in a salsa class, actually transfers to a healthy relationship, such as a man is taught not to put his hand in guiding her from the soft tissue because that can hurt her. Well, women are typically softer in how you communicate to them and they'll take it more personally. So you need to give subtle signs in your touch and what's appropriate. And she's going to give you subtle signs. You've got to know those subtle signs in her looks, in her movement that says, hold on, wait, she doesn't want to hurt you, and say, stop, 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 because she's starting to trigger. But she's going to do and pull in. And he has to be mindful enough of her body language to understand it and respect that boundary she's putting up, because she's not used to saying, stop, back, I'm ready to trigger. She may not have that language yet. And even if she did, then the man's typically going to feel like, I've hurt her, I'll just lay back. And then she feels abandoned. And there you go, abandoning me because I didn't put myself out for you. And it's a downward spiral. But in learning salsa, we're going to open up those lines of communication and how salsa really transfers to life. And we try to really look at healing in a whole manner, and looking at movement and art and how all of those actually play right into life, and how we can learn from life's experiences and our different passions, whether it be sculpting, and how as a sculptor's working on a throw, that when something's not working, it can be pushed down and start all over. And sometime we're going to have to feel like, okay, we're going to ground zero and we're going to work our way up from here because that wasn't working. And there are so many life lessons just waiting to be taught. And we're waiting to do that with the assistance of finances, so we can, you know, pull in. One, we don't have our own personal space. We are borrowing three different locations. And if we had the appropriate donations, whether it be in one-time donations, and it could be $10, it could be $1, all of that adds up. And I hate to bring it to money, but really, in order for us to be able to completely continue on this path, we're going to need our own space. And we really need people to stand in the gap for our families, to bridge from pain to healing. And so we're just really asking people to go to www.aquarterblue.org. That's AQUARTER. BLUE.org. And right there, you click on donate, and we'll take your pennies and your dollars and anything more that you have there. Because that, I don't want that to get in my way of really getting in with these family. And I have, as executive director, I not only am having an amazing work working with these families, but a lot of my time I have to do in fundraising too. And I'd so much love for that to take care of itself and be able to focus on the healing of this family, because that's really what's going to make the difference. And if the money could just come in so I don't have to stress about that, that would be an amazing blessing.
It would be. And there's so much work to be done. And there's so much going out to the public and spreading the word, because we're still... It's still one of those taboo subjects to be talking about in general in public. And it's, like I said before, it's hard to start that conversation. Most people want to shy away from it because it's like, okay, what am I supposed to say about this? How am I supposed to react? And how am I supposed to react if I am an unhealed victim and I'm put into that conversation? It brings up a lot of discomfort, but it's what needs to be brought out and needs to be talked about. I think for the horrible things that have happened, the Jerry Sandusky case hopefully is going to start opening up that channel, and people are going to be starting to talk about that more, because I know when that whole story was on for months and months, people were starting to talk about it in public and how unbelievable they thought that the whole situation was. But if I was in one of those conversations, I'm going, look, this has been going on for ages.
Right.
But it's finally coming to more of the forefront of public, because it is starting to be talked about more. And you watch the evening news, it's almost every week there is some teacher being busted for being a perpetrator now. Have you noticed that?
Well, the challenge that I see, and I hear people when they talk about my work, is they'll say certain things like, I'm glad you're helping those people. I'm glad you're helping women. I don't care if you're male or female, I will help you. I don't care your race. I don't care your economic status. I don't care if you're legal or not. It's a crime that is crossing all generations, all races, all economic statuses. It's not picking and choosing. What people do with like the Sandusky case is they say, well, it's because they were troubled youth. It's because their moms weren't, you know, pouring into them. Okay, I wasn't a troubled youth. I was an innocent little girl. My parents just celebrated this week 64 years of marriage. I didn't have a broken home. I was undereducated. They were naive. It happens to everyone. And so many parents think that it would never happen in their home. But if we live under that veil, we actually leave our children vulnerable. And we need to stop thinking it happens to those people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, while it appears like we're being very understanding about this crime now, it's not taboo anymore, you know, people who aren't Catholic are saying, oh, that happens in the Catholic Church. It doesn't happen to us. It does. It just hasn't been exposed yet.
And it can happen to anybody. That's the whole thing. And the thing is, too, there is educational material out there. There are coloring books out there. If you're uncomfortable with talking about your child or your niece or nephew or whoever it may be, the little ones in your life about it, go get a little coloring book. They can color, you can read the script underneath it, and you can start opening that up and just teach them a little bit about protecting themselves, because you can't always be there to protect them. That is the truth of life. We can't, for as much good intentions as we may send our children out there with, we can't protect them all the time.
No, we have to educate them. And on our website at aquarterblue.org, those resources are available there. And we ask you to cover the mailing cost. You can also download them. But those materials are there so you can have those conversations if you don't know the words you want to look for. And we want to help you in bridging that conversation with your children, because we know a lot of people don't even know where to start. And at the youngest of ages, you are allowing them to control their bodies and care for them. Also, you do not force physical touch. If they don't want to hug somebody or kiss someone, don't force them. Exhibit that their opinions matter. Our neighbor girl, she's 18 months old, and she loves spending time with me and going and seeing our dogs and our lizards. But when her mom and dad say, hey, hug Martha, and she says my name, I'll literally be working in my home office and I'll hear her yelling for me. I stop what I'm doing and I go out and talk to her. But when they say, hug Aunt Martha, she shakes her head no. And I go, it's fine. And she'll hug my husband, but spend less time with him. She'll want to spend time with him, and it's totally fine. She doesn't need to hug me. She doesn't need to kiss me. For whatever her logic is, it makes no sense to me, but it doesn't matter. I want her to know that her boundaries are awesome. And I tell her, even though she's young, I'm so proud of you for saying what you want and don't want. And it's only with a head shake. And that's the kind of behavior we need to be exhibiting to our children, to let them know their opinions do matter.
Mm-hmm. And when they tell us that they're being abused somehow, don't turn around as that they're telling fairy tales or lies, or where did you ever get that kind of story from?
Right.
And to actually sit and listen to them and believe them.
Children don't really have the ability to make this stuff up. And I mean, there was a case here in Los Angeles, and two little girls went to the counselor and told them what the teacher was doing when he was making semen cookies. And they just, you're just so creative and you're making these stories up. Just go ahead and stop elaborating and making these stories up. How would a child make that up? Mm-hmm. I couldn't have made that up.
No.
And we need to understand that children don't make this up. And at the same time, you as an individual parent may be wounded by someone you're dating or that. Never, ever use this, create this story, this lie, and plant that into your child to get even with that other person. All you're doing is endangering other children who are really being molested. Never make this story up. Never. And if it does happen, share it with someone. If they don't believe you, share it with someone else. If they don't believe you, share it with someone else until you are believed. Get the help you need and get the help that individual needs so they get in a place where they are no longer endangering other children, because you are not the only one. There are other victims of that perpetrator.
Yes, believe the children and go get help. Go seek whoever is going to help you with the situation.
Right. You don't need to have all the facts. You need to tell the authorities so they can do their job and investigate.
Exactly. Martha Nix Wade, thank you so much. The founder and executive director of A Quarter Blue, thank you so much for bringing this to the forefront.
Thank you for being willing.
Thank you. And I want to remind our listeners, if you'd like to get this again, download it from iTunes, from Psych One on One. And thank you so much for being here and listening and being open-minded and getting the information that is so important to everybody. And take care of yourself. Take care of each other. I'm Julie Ann Good, and this has been Psych One on One. Thank you so much.